Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
I'm old enough to remember HAL from Stanley Kubrick's Space Odyssey. In 1968, HAL was an advanced computer which used artificial intelligence and served as the main antagonist of the series. The years since Space Odyssey have seen the lines between fact and fiction blurred and crossed. It is an example of futurism in action. What are the possibilities of medicine in the future? It's not a question for our entertainment. Preparing physicians, healthcare systems, and patients for future care impacts the speed and efficiency of future medical benefits for society. My guest today is an international expert on the future of medicine and its implications. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Ferdelyn Mesko. Dr. Mesko is the director of the Medical Futurist Institute. He has been featured by such media outlets as CNN, National Geographic, the BBC, the New York Times, and Forbes, just to name a few. Dr. Mesko has given keynote addresses for leading academic centers, as well as medical industry leaders. He is an author of international renown, and we are very fortunate today to have Ferdelyn Mesko. Welcome to Sound Practice.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure. In your book, The Guide to the Future of Medicine, Technology and the Human Touch, you explore the future of healthcare through the lenses of emerging technologies. What's the core message you hope readers will take away from your work?
First of all, as the medical futurist, I'm usually asked about, you know, the name few technologies that would dominate the next few years, the next decade in medicine and healthcare, but I always start with patient empowerment. So today's discussions are always about artificial intelligence and digital health sensors, all these really exciting advanced technologies that have been becoming part of everyday care through evidence-based medicine. But I still think that the biggest milestone in the history of medicine is simply patients becoming members of their own medical team, creating an equal level partnership with their primary care physicians. That's huge and unprecedented. And I always felt like that patients have been the most underused resource of healthcare. So there's one thing anyone would get from my work, from the studies that we published at the Medical Futurist Institute, from the analysis I publish daily on medicalfuturist.com or the videos we have on the YouTube channel. It's that patient empowerment is the most important aspect or transformational shift or paradigm shift in today's healthcare. And of course, it comes with a range of advanced technologies, and I'm happy to name a few I'm a bit more excited about than the other ones, but this is the most important thing, because patient empowerment in itself will lead to high-level trends that will, I think, dominate the discussions when it comes to how we should practice medicine, how we should deliver healthcare, such as patients are becoming the point of care themselves, meaning they receive diagnosis, monitoring, or treatment wherever they are through the access to advanced technologies that they have. Through global supply chains, healthcare is becoming globalized, which is very important for policy and decision makers about what kind of guidelines and policies they come up with when their target customers, the patients, won't just access technologies they roll out to the market in that specific country, but wherever they want to because of those global supply chains. So getting back to your initial question, I would definitely highlight the parts of artificial intelligence that would be made available to the general public. I'm talking about generative AI-based large language models like ChatGPT that have been used by more than 500 million people by now, simply making it the most popular AI technology in the world. I would definitely highlight those AI-based solutions that patients can use on their phones, like skin checking applications or those checking or measuring vocal biomarkers. And the digital health revolution has been with us for at least a decade. So just the opportunity to finally obtain data that we used to have in our bodies, but we had no interfaces to access them, coming from sleep through fitness activities to even like genetic analysis. This is quite important, and I think these will be the major points I would like everyone to get from my work. But again, patient empowerment is the absolute number one priority.
It seems to me that with patient empowerment, there is a potential fear of healthcare discrepancies or some groups doing better because of socioeconomic position or intellectual position to be able to take advantage of healthcare as we move forward. Is that a fear of yours?
That's an absolutely valid threat. I would even go as far as saying that just the access to certain advanced technologies might lead to biological differences. Just imagine, you know, as a futurist, I often play with the what if question. Like, here is a what if scenario. What if a patient can buy a 3D bioprinted liver tissue in 5 years from now, but another patient has to wait for an organ transplantation, technically for someone to die, which is an awful kind of discrepancy or difference between them. So the threat is valid. However, I think the practical reality of today is about the observation that not even geek people like me can enjoy the benefits yet of this digital health paradigm shift, you know, to the most of its potentials. So as long as it's not working for geeks who are great at analyzing data, who are happy to dive into using technologies and even lose some privacy while accessing those technologies, who are happy to devote time, attention, privacy, energy, and money into trying to contribute to their own health and disease management. Until that's the case, the everyday case, I cannot expect the system to solve this for everyone else who might be even against using advanced technologies or just have discrepancies in health, digital health, or technological equity.
You bring up privacy, and that's always a concern. But it seems to me that the general public is all too willing to give up privacy in exchange for benefits, sometimes very small benefits. Yeah, I'm thinking outside of healthcare. Do you believe that privacy concerns will be a major obstacle as we move forward?
I cannot imagine that, but I think I'm a very pragmatic person about the topic. I always say that I don't think bad actors care about my blood pressure measurements or, you know, ECG recordings. And I don't want to ridiculize the importance of the issue of privacy, but I think billions of people having given up their privacy, as you mentioned, in exchange for small benefits. I'm talking about all the people using social media companies and their profiles and the platforms. And we signed all these agreements. And now when we have a discussion why the phone is in our pocket, the next day we will start getting advertisements based on the discussion we had. This is not something, you know, this topic anymore. That's part of how these amazingly advanced AI algorithms have been curating the feeds, the stream, the content, the advertisements for us. So I think, why don't people care about or worry about this part of their privacy leaking all the time? Why there are simply amazing advantages, evidence-based advantages that they can gain by using a few digital health technologies. So again, as a pragmatic person, I like to say that until we can either prevent diseases from happening or help catch them as early as possible, I wouldn't worry about privacy. When this is the utopia we are living in, that we can catch diseases early or outright prevent them from happening by using a range of advanced technologies, I think maybe then we can start worrying about privacy issues.
Fair enough. I'm interested in the balance of art and science when it comes to medicine. And it seems that when we talk about future technology, it's heavily weighted to the science. Do you fear a loss of art or the human touch to medicine?
Well, you pegged two major, huge topics into one very well formulated questions. I will try to uncover both. About the first one, even the inclusion of advanced technologies in medicine, it only works through the rules of evidence-based medicine. If we lose that, I think we lose everything. So I'd like to tell, when I talk to technology-focused companies about how they can conquer healthcare, I always tell them that even if you come up with the history's best innovation in healthcare that could save millions of lives or made the jobs of millions of healthcare professionals better from day one. If you cannot prove the safety and efficiency of your technology through peer-reviewed studies, if you cannot prove it through clinical trials, simply nobody in healthcare is allowed to use them. That's how the system works, and it's a very good system because we have to make sure that anything we use on the market, whether it's a biological product, a guideline, a system, a service, an at-home lab test, or an advanced technology, it must the rules of evidence-based medicine must apply for those individual products too. But about your second issue, and I've been spending my last few years doing research about that topic, the billion-dollar question: will we use the human touch when we can simply implement such amazing technologies like artificial intelligence or generative AI now? I don't think that's the case. I think the case is the opposite. We physicians, I think for centuries, have been thinking that we have been pursuing the art of medicine because we know technically how hard it is, to diagnose a patient, to find out which test to use, which symptoms to focus on, which treatment to prescribe. So we have been thinking that this has been the art of medicine, this part that we have been, that this kind of practice we have been doing already. I think the opposite is the case. When artificial intelligence starts finding treatments, cures, diagnostic options that no clinician or scientist has even thought about for centuries, and we have been having quite smart scientists and healthcare professionals working on these problems for centuries, if not millennia, that's going to be the real era of the art of medicine, when we have to start finding out based on the biological background that we have, our background in technologies, in coding, in pathology, and all these, how could AI come to such an amazing conclusion when we couldn't? Or how could AI find such unusual associations that simply shape how we think about the disease? Like when there was a study about how AI started finding patterns in the phone recordings of elderly patients about finding biomarkers for diagnosing them for Alzheimer's disease, that's an unusual association. When an AI is able to tell a patient's skin color based on a chest x-ray, which would technically, it should be impossible because the human eye is not able to do that, but AI finds something based on which it will make very efficient decisions about this question, this is an unusual association. I think these associations are the most exciting parts of AI research these days. Thus, when it comes to an influx of such amazing studies and research results that we have to deal with, that will come from using a range of AI-based technologies, I think that will bring us the real art of medicine. And I'm not sure if the healthcare workforce is ready for that yet, but that's why it's such a beautiful bioethical debate for now.
Are predictions of future technology more accurate than predictions of future human behavior?
What a good question to ask. Can you please say it again?
Sure. Are predictions of future technology more accurate than predictions of future human behavior?
The question immediately brought me back to one of my science fiction favorites, Isaac Asimov's Psychohistory in a Foundation series, in which, human behavior cannot be predicted, but looking at the masses and how the behavior of civilizations can take place, that's a different question. In general, as a futurist, and then I will try to address your question, but in general, as a futurist, I have a hard time talking about predictions because predictions by themselves imply that there is one future ahead. And as a professional futurist, it should be my job to tell you what is going to happen and exactly when on that singular futuristic timeline, while in fact multiple futures exist. And the methods that we futurists use, the futures methods, are available for analyzing those potential futures, observing them, even choosing those futures we like a bit more than the others. And then there is even a method called backcasting with which we can go back towards today and find out, well, what kind of steps we could make in legal, technological, social, cultural, emotional terms to have a higher chance to reach the desired future scenarios, not the other ones around. So I think making predictions about future technologies doesn't make much sense because, at least in my mind, the work that futurists do should have an impact on decision making today. So instead of predictions, I like to come up with visions or scenarios, because these can help decision making today. But if I start making blind predictions, what if I make 20 perfect predictions, but my 21st will be a flop? How can you trust my 22nd? That's my issue with predictions in general. But now addressing your question, of course, it's incredibly hard, if not impossible, predicting the behavior of people. And that's why we at the Medical Futurist have been publishing studies for over a decade about why digital health is primarily a cultural transformation. Because I think, in fact, it's quite easy to predict the technological evolution of blood pressure monitors, digital stethoscopes, wearable sensors, AI, and all these. Many people have been doing that, hopefully myself included. But it's always a cultural transformation, because if you start implementing all these really advanced state-of-the-art technologies in a hospital today, I guarantee that the quality of care will not get better, not even a year from now, because people work in the system, and some of them might be overhyping these technologies, while the others might outright reject them because they have emotional fears maybe about the technology replacing them in their job. And that's why decision makers and policymakers and government officials have to understand the cultural background of such decisions or fears or the reason for overhyping a certain technology before even thinking about how to facilitate the progress of technology. I hope that somehow addressed the question.
It does, but it seems to raise a question that certain cultures may be able to adopt new technology faster or slower than others. Is that accurate?
I think it is, but what I assume the question implies is that whether there's a difference between the digital health adoption in general. And I think that those countries that, you know, might not be the most like technologically advanced, or that's not the right expression. So what I want to say is that there are countries with a more like consumerist approach, where the voice of the consumer is extremely important, because that's how the whole country, that's where the culture of the country is coming from. I'm talking about the United States, for example. That's an example where digital health revolution has been progressing at an incredible pace. But we have countries like in Eastern Europe, where I live, where the consumer in healthcare has no voice. We have been having a Prussian system, even in education, where as a consumer, I just have to digest what I get. But why would I try to contribute to the table? I have nothing to say. I just have to follow the prescriptions I've been given. So in countries like with this kind of approach or mindset, we see definitely a slower adoption rate of technologies. But in consumerist countries where consumers have a voice, it's a much better progress. But at the end of the day, I think what will matter is how an individual, what kind of mindset an individual patient has about their own health and disease management. Because of global supply chains, because of social media and patient community sites and the access to technologies without through geographical borders, for all these reasons, I think, and maybe it's a very controversial statement, but I think it starts mattering less and less which country's healthcare system we belong to, rather than or compared to how many technologies, how much data, how many services we get access to individually through global supply chains.
Very interesting. Your research emphasizes preparing healthcare systems for a future driven by AI and digital health. What practical steps should policymakers and medical professionals take today to ensure they're ready for the rapid advancements you foresee in the next 2 to 5 years?
I think they have to follow very different paths forward. For decision or policymakers, I like to build upon the examples I've seen while traveling around the world and giving speeches. One step is definitely about a government making sure that they announce publicly that it's part of their own responsibility to further empower patients. In Denmark and Germany, I've seen such examples, governments saying this out loud. So it's not that the government just accepts that there are empowered patients in the system. It's their job to further empower every single patient in the country who wants to get empowered. I think it's a very important, not just philosophical like sentence, but it's a statement that the country has to put on the table. Also, for decision makers, I've seen great examples from the American and the Canadian Medical Association about providing clear and practical guidelines for their healthcare workforce about using advanced technologies, working with empowered patients, analyzing the data coming from wearable sensors, for example, in primary care. And I think other medical associations have been following their lead. I've seen great examples about regulating advanced technologies, and the US FDA definitely stands out of the crowd. We've been analyzing at the Medical Futurist the work that they have been doing for over a decade now. And when we published the first study about all the FDA-approved AI-based medical technologies in 2020, that was the first study about having such a database, we found 64 of such technologies in the FDA's official database. Now they have over 1,500. So in less than 5 years, there has been an extraordinary progress in that. And I think other regulatory agencies are just following their lead. Talking about the healthcare workforce, I think it's a different path. They need much more practical like steps forward, because it's not like you can change the engine in an airplane while you are taking place on that flight. You are on that flight. It's just not technically possible. So you cannot tell the healthcare workforce to start, you know, reskilling yourself in the next couple of decades, because then you will be ready for this paradigm shift when their patients keep coming to them with questions about technologies, data, even AI. It used to be about, you know, Dr. Google, patients Googling symptoms. Now it's about Dr. AI, patients asking ChatGPT for a complex set of questions that they can bring to the next doctor-patient meeting, and what treatment regimen they should have, what strategy they should follow while trying to do their disease or health management. So they need practical skills about communication now. They need a very specific skill, which I even published a paper about why that skill is the most important emerging skill in medicine today. I'm talking about prompt engineering, the ability to write the most precise, most efficient prompts or text-based briefs for generative AI agents, the large language models like ChatGPT. So they can use that tool as an absolute assistant 24/7 that I think all the medical professionals have been longing for since the dawn of modern medicine. But finally, we have that assistant that we can use whenever we want to be as efficient as possible if we know how to use it. I stop here. There are many more things that we can implement into the medical curricula, into the general guidelines of medical associations. I started working with the Royal College of Surgeons and Physicians in Canada. I will be the visiting professor for them for 1 year. So I will have an absolutely lucky position to witness this revolution from the front lines, discussing with the CEO and all the staff about which technologies to implement into the guidelines, or which technological and communication skills to focus on. So then the next generation of at least physicians and healthcare professionals in Canada can deal with this revolution. But in general, I think it's extremely exciting to witness this paradigm shift these years.
It is fascinating and exciting. You just spoke about preparing future physicians for where we're headed. I'm interested from the point of view of a patient. Any thoughts on what patients should do to prepare themselves to best utilize the future of medicine?
When I started publishing my work and was sharing it more publicly as the Medical Futurist, I thought that eventually medical professionals would reach out to start having discussions about what they can do differently. But in fact, a lot more patients have been reaching out to me, to us at the Medical Futurist, about exactly this question, what they can do to better contribute to their own disease and health management. Now these years, it's about their own longevity, because it's not enough for them just to do a good job after receiving a diagnosis, but even they want to become member of healthcare before, fortunately, having any diagnosis on the table, so they can start contributing to the longevity. And the first thing I always tell them, that please don't buy technologies, please don't start using an AI for this purpose, but please start asking these questions at the next meeting with your primary care physician. Because at the core of this whole transformation, we have to find a new partnership between physicians and patients. And this partnership usually can be found in primary care, in the first line of healthcare. If they have a partnership with their primary care physician, if they can formulate their questions about these issues, about whether to use technologies to measure sleep or fitness activities, or whether to turn to a, you know, database service or at-home lab test for their disease management. If they have a partnership, then they can discuss it and they can form their medical team. They can even start creating preventive plans to avoid diseases from happening. And only after that comes the possibility of using a range of advanced technologies, at-home lab tests, online services, genetic tests, AI-based applications, and all these. Because if they start with technologies, I guarantee everyone they will feel doomed and very alone with a lot of decisions to be made, with a lot of data flowing into their systems. And I know that because even as a physician by training, as a scientist and a geek, I've tried every single digital health technology out there. I've had like 7 genetic testing services, and I've tried everything out there to experience what the future, what the patient from the future would go through in terms of challenges and opportunities. And I confirmed that. I felt many times anxious about waiting for the results of a genetic test, or I felt doomed with so much data to handle. And without a partner primary care physician, I would have been lost in that jungle of information. So in an ideal way, the primary care physician could become like the healthcare navigator for the patient. And that's why I always advise patients to, as a first step, please start at least cultivating or creating that relationship with your primary care physician, because that's where your longevity journey will start.
Do you think that patients will spend more or less time with their primary care physicians as we move into the future?
Ultimately, less time with them, but the transition will be painful. So by ultimately, I mean that I think remote care will have to become the norm, not because it's better than in-person care. Of course it is not, but 5 million healthcare workers are missing according to the WHO right now. That's going to be 10 million by 2030. So simply, physically and technically, we cannot train as many healthcare professionals as we need, while the number of patients requiring medical help will keep on increasing, because simply we get better at diagnosing them and caring for them on the long term. For this purpose, I think remote care will become the new norm, and eventually we will have to spend less and less time with our primary care physician. But throughout the transition, it's going to be painful for both stakeholders. Patients will have to learn how to deal with the data they can finally obtain about themselves, how to discuss such questions about technologies with their primary care physicians, and how to use the expertise of that physician in their own longevity journey. At the same time, primary care physicians will have to learn how to provide advice about using such technologies. And we cannot expect them to have an answer for everything. And I like to share the experience I've had with my own primary care physician. Of course, I've been bringing her all my new technologies and the results from my genetic tests and all these. And once I had a few questions and she said, look, I don't know the answer to your questions, but come sit next to me. Let's do a search together. Let's find out the answers together. And I think that's the mindset that primary care physicians need, that we cannot expect them to know the answer to everything, but we can expect them to have a proactive approach about understanding even the technological sides of healthcare.
Do you think that future physicians will be judged not by what they know, but by what they can access?
In terms of technologies, absolutely. Because it's a very good question, because it's very specific. Of course, there will be many things they will don't know, but they will have access to a range of technologies, including generative AI, through which they can really quickly try to obtain the information, the point or piece of information that they specifically need. And if they cannot do that, that's going to be an issue. So it's okay to say, I don't know, but it will not be okay to say, that's it. I cannot help because I don't know. No, you need to have access to a range of technologies. You need to have the skills needed to obtain the bits of information you need right away to help that patient with that specific question. And I think that's something we can expect them to be able to put on the table.
I'd like to shift focus, because I so rarely get to speak to a futurist. I'm interested a little bit in your career and what you find the most rewarding aspects of it to be. You've spoken all over the world. You've met with leaders of healthcare internationally, what do you find the most rewarding in your career as a medical futurist?
I think it's after doing this, like I'm 40, but I started this 20 years ago, even during my medical student years. So I don't feel like, you know, a young researcher anymore. I've been doing this for 2 decades, but still the biggest reward is my scientific curiosity and trying to fulfill that curiosity. Be just simply being able to do research about whatever I'm interested in those months or years. This independent research like stage or mindset is what is bringing me forward. And the reason why is very simple. If my reward system would be about whether the things I'm talking about, the technologies I'm trying to highlight and the like high level aspects and trends in healthcare I'm trying to highlight, if these are the ones I would like to see, like, you know, being played out in public, like being enjoyed by patients and physicians and all these, I would be in trouble. Because if I do a really good job, then those things I'm talking about now will only like become reality in 5-10 years from now. And I don't want to brag, but I have a good track record about this going back 10-15 years. But when you set something in a scientific study, like in 2025, and now like regarding AI and the art of medicine, that's becoming true today, 10 years later, it's not really a reward because you talked about this 10 years ago. My scientific curiosity about that issue was fulfilled 10 years ago. So it's just not enough for me anymore to see that, you know, being played out in the practical reality of medicine today. So I have to keep on focusing on just simply being a curious scientist. And I'm very lucky to have a situation in which I can try to tackle, you know, whatever range of scientific questions I have in front of me, because that's the independence I'm enjoying now.
Let's talk about ethical and regulatory concerns you have for physicians. Can you speak about that?
Absolutely, because I think this is the topic that I've been addressing the most in the last couple of years. My biggest fear is that regulators whose job is to bring technologies to the market in a safe and efficient way when technologies are ready for that, if they are not knowledgeable enough, it might mean that there will be like a long delay in patients getting access to those technologies. At least that's what used to be the general issue about this. Now it's different. Now patients can get access to those technologies even before those technologies become accessible on the market or being proven safe and efficient. One example that comes to mind is about how thousands of patients with diabetes in the US started making their own artificial pancreas systems at home in a do-it-yourself way, because technologically, they became able to create or connect an insulin pump to a blood glucose sensor, and an AI-based algorithm that was available in the cloud running on their smartwatch could make the system work. Such devices are now on the market, but for years, regulators were very slow at adopting and regulating these technologies, but patients found a way. My fear, if this keeps being the case, regulators being, you know, lagging a bit behind the frontline of innovation, I'm afraid patients will find a way. And that's something not ideal. While I perfectly understand their motive and reasoning behind that, if patients start accessing such technologies before those being proven safe and efficient, that will definitely lead to a dystopic scenario.
Very interesting. As our time together comes to an end, I'm interested in what you are working on and in what research you are doing with the Medical Futurist Institute. Can you give us a highlight of things to come?
Absolutely. Last year, we published, I think, one of our most important studies about exploring how futures methods have been used across the healthcare and medical and life science industries for decades. And what we have been working on is making medical future studies a new like subdivision of life sciences. I think it's important because the future of therapeutic areas, medical specialties, the technological progress, the future has been discussed in many studies and papers, but just like a form of like subjective opinions, never in a systematic way, using methods that professional futurists have been using for decades. And I would like to prove that it's possible to adopt at least a few basic methods, whether it's about hospital managers' vision about their hospital's future or a regulator's vision about regulating advanced technologies in 5 to 10 years. It's possible to use futures methods. So with my PhD students and some colleagues around the world, now we are working on several trajectories about using different kinds of futures methods for this purpose. So one is using scenario analysis for analyzing how generative AI will impact the future of medical education. In one project, we are trying to define longevity for the masses and for science projects. In other one, we are using the futures view method, but we also use forecasting too. So in general, we are trying to prove that different futures methods are useful for very specific reasons and purposes in medicine and healthcare. And when it comes to discussing the future of these very important fields, this should be based, the debate should be based on the systematic use of scientific methods rather than just the subjective opinions of key opinion leaders.
Excellent. You are doing important work for all of us, and I thank you. You're a true physician leader. My guest has been Ferdelin Meska. Dr. Meska, thank you so much.
The pleasure was mine. Thank you so much for having me.
My thanks to Ferdelin Meska. Dr. Meska's work is important on many levels. He is a true physician leader. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. That is holy cow, Batman and Robin, Rick Capow.